This evening's talk is on doubt, which I think really is this fascinating topic, and just telling people that that's what the topic is, everyone wants to tell you a story, you know, and I certainly have a lot of my own. Excuse me, I'm a little tired tonight. I'm kind of running on low energy, so I'm trying to get my energy up. So this is part of a series of talks that I've given this year. If you go back and look at the talks that I've given in 2018, I made a conscious effort to try to really go back to stress a series of basic elements that I think are essential to practice, and from talking with people, getting emails, working with some people individually, have the feeling that some of the most basic things about practice are kind of being glossed over or overlooked with mindfulness and practice becoming so popular, that there is such a diversity of teaching that for many people, I think it's hard to focus their attention on practice. And it's easy to kind of get just a little bit off base or off balance. So. And that goes with this talk, and I think you'll see that. So there is this kind of series of traditional descriptions of like what you do when you have doubt, particularly about your practice. And I'm actually not going to talk too much about those. I'm going to talk about what at least traditionally is considered the heartwood or the core response to doubt, which is a practice response. And then if that doesn't work, then the things that we more commonly associate with the response, you then try those. And so that'll probably be the next talk. I don't have a handout tonight. I've tried to be preparing fairly detailed handouts that I hope are helpful, that have footnotes and resources. So next time there will be one that will cover this and what I'm hope to talk about then. But I want to just mention two resources that I think are helpful. And they have a lot of clarity to them. They're about traditional practice. And so the first one is by Sayadaw Upandita. And, you know, Upandita was this, like, towering figure in Theravada Buddhism in Burma, in Myanmar. He just died 2 years ago. And he was a seminal teacher for two of our three senior guiding teachers, for Kamala Masters and Stephen Armstrong. Both of them ordained Steve for, I think, 7 years, and Kamala for a shorter period. But, you know, all of the, most of the major figures in Western Theravada Buddhism, people like Joseph Goldstein and that whole group of people, all have been to Burma to study with Upandita. So this book is called In This Very Life, The Liberation Teachings of the Buddha. And it's the transcripts that have been edited of his talks during a retreat. A lot of the language that he uses, or, you know, this is some time ago. So the language that he uses is, I guess, a little outdated in the way that we're languaging things now. But I actually think that's helpful, because it really gives you, for me, a much clearer idea of the origin of the way the teachings and their application were developing. And if you trace back who Upandita's teachers were, you know, I mean, you go right to the source. I mean, it's amazing. So you really begin to appreciate, you know, why people like Stephen and Kamala are the teachers that they are, you know, that this is passed down. So In This Very Life by Sayadaw Upandita. And the other one, this is a more modern book by Bhante Gutanaramana, is called Meditation on Perception, 10 Healing Practices to Cultivate Mindfulness, with an introduction by Bhikkhu Bodhi. It's relatively short chapters, but very, very clear. And once again, from a Theravadan perspective. So just recommend those that you take a look at that. Okay, so let's talk about doubt. I had to roll up my shirt sleeves to get ready to talk about this. You know, the thing about doubt is that in the right amount and at the right time, it's this terribly important and helpful thing. You know, it acts as a real incentive to drive investigation and reflection and change. And when it reaches a depth or intensity, a certain depth or intensity, it's just the reverse. It can become very harmful, and then it can just proliferate, serve as the base for all kinds of other unskillful and unhealthy mind states, and pretty much it certainly disable your practice, and it can disable your life and slide into depression and be a real problem. So kind of the way to the way that this is presented and the way that it's being presented now is kind of applying to every level of doubt that seems problematic. Historically, when we talk about doubt, we're talking about really serious doubt. And so from a characteristic standpoint, it's described as a mind which is divided and wavering, so that it's unable to come to a conclusion or to a clear, solid judgment. So there's just this constant vacillation back and forth. So there's a proliferation of judgments. Along with the proliferation of judgments is a proliferation of personalization. That's basically the Honeyball Sutta. And then along with that is the mind losing its ability to evaluate the relative legitimacy or value of the different judgments that the mind is making. You know, should I do this? Should I do that? And historically, you know, you say, well, you could have a doubt in the Buddha, you could have a doubt in the teachings, you could have doubt in the teacher, you could have a doubt in the methods of practice. You know, you have self-doubt that all of those are okay, but you don't know or can't do those things. And then that's what you normally hear. And then you go into the literature and this issue about discrimination of the relative values of things. It talks about the mind being able to not tell, to discern, for example, like what is actually healthy or unhealthy to do from a dharmic perspective, or what the path is and what the path isn't. You know, it really starts to dig in and just undermine everything. and then, you know, I think this is an interesting characteristic, and it's not one that just jumps out immediately, but then, you know, you think about it, and one of the characteristics is that the mind becomes exhausted by excessive and unproductive thinking and reasoning. So this vacillation and this inability to settle, see clearly, and make a sound decision is lost. And the mind just keeps churning it. And of course, yeah, I mean, even studies now show that when you keep revisiting and trying to think through and figure out an issue, that you actually become less productive and less skillful. There's all kinds of studies on that. They have nothing to do with the Dharma. So this, like many other disruptive, dysfunctional states of mind, has this baseline character of the mind going out of balance, losing its balance. And then there's all kinds of consequences to that. So the same thing happens with restlessness and anxiety. But It's accompanied by different things than doubt. But they have this common feature that the mind goes out of balance. Same thing with desire and aversion. And with sloth and torpor, low energy inability to gain traction, either in of the energy in the body or of the mind. Same thing. It's gone out of it's gone out of balance a different way. You know, normally we think of excess energy, right? Where with a sloth and torpor, it's the energy is too low, so the mind is going out of balance the other way. And here, you know, one of the characteristics of doubt, as with restlessness and anxiety, is as the mind does this proliferation of discursive thinking, it's usually accompanied with all kinds of emotions. And then the inability of the mind to discern that and settle, you know, the energy behind all of those emotions just starts to really take off. So it can just be so physically uncomfortable, doubt can. And then, you know, it goes over a peak and the mind starts to shut down, you know, to escape from the confusion and all of the energy. So I had said before the sitting, you know, just kind of hold the question, not to really reflect on it during the sitting, of, well, what is the proximate cause of doubt? So anybody have a thought about that? You know, for me, historically, I say, well, I tend to know when I start to doubt things. You know, there's a series of markers for me that I've identified, and frequently it has to do with, you know, how much sleep I've had, how tired I am, the level of challenge that I'm facing, particular situations, particular people. You know, so that's kind of a classical Western evaluation. You can probably see where I'm going with that. Those aren't the proximate causes. So does anybody have any idea what the proximate cause is? Yes?
Fear of the unknown.
A fear of the unknown, okay.
A fear that I'm not doing the right thing.
Yeah, so there's this uncertainty, right? And then that uncertainty can proliferate in a bunch of different ways, right? It can just be anxiety, or it can escalate up into fear.
To underscore that, maybe fear of too many choice, you know, having too many choices.
That's right. One of my favorite stories, and this isn't a doubt story, but it's kind of the illustration of that, in a way that Munindra another Indian Theravadan teacher that influenced a lot of Western teachers, used to come over in the summers and stay with Kamala in Hawaii for the summer. And so she said it was just hilarious to go to the grocery store with him, because you know, if you've ever been to India and been to Bodh Gaya, which is where he was, you know, I mean, you know, your choices when you go into a place, I mean, there's just not that many, okay? So she said, you know, they would go in and he'd like go into the cereal roll, you know, or the canned vegetable roll, and she couldn't get him to leave, you know, and she would say, why is this so interesting? And he'd say, well, there's just so many choices, you know? And he was just fascinated with, like, well, why would there be so many choices for a can of beans, you know? And he just studied it and worked with it and everything. You know, now, he wasn't in doubt, but, I mean, like, it was like, wow, this is just unbelievable, you know? So any other thoughts? Yeah.
Sometimes maybe the opposite of that, like you think that there's only one choice and you've got to get it right.
But not sure what that is.
Not sure what it is.
Yeah.
It's like the importance of a single choice.
Yeah.
There's no tomorrow to correct.
Yeah. Which is about a future consequence, right?
Yeah.
Like what is the outcome of the decision that I'm contemplating? Yeah.
I mean, a lot us over the season of this too many things going and doubt about too many emotions, too many thoughts, and conflicting emotions, want to know the right choices as far as Buddhism, right acts, and then my feelings get involved, and there's disturbances, and then I remember there's doubt, but then I remember from doubt, I remember when I studied law, also intervening act, like there's an intervening act that's causation from an intervening act, Prosperon Torts, you know, it was long, many years ago, but I forgot all that.
Okay, so the kind of doubt that's arising here is
causation, like something happens, like karma, cause and effect. So I was wondering if all the causes I made has brought me to this point. So the causes of causation. So it causes me sometimes. How do I react?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know this is an important point because. You can hear that this is a cognitive conceptual evaluation, right? And that is one of the core problems with doubt. And from a Buddhist perspective, while sound reasoning can be helpful, the conceptualization and trying to figure things out is not the answer. It's actually the problem. Because it almost always leads to personalizing it. You know, so one of the things I'm going to talk about is that if you notice your, I'm going to give a mundane, ridiculous illustration, but I think it's one everybody can relate to. But if you find, if you see your mind asking why questions, you're probably, from a practice perspective, heading in the wrong direction, because why questions will almost always move into conceptualization, which then goes into personalization. And if the questions are, you know, I questions, you know, why is this happening to me? Why did I do this? I can't believe I did any of those. Then from a practice perspective, you're already way down the line, you know, you're generations down the line of issues, and trying to start at that place to figure it out, if you're in serious doubt, is just going to proliferate, you know. So, okay, so I'm gonna yeah.
So is it ignorance a wrong view?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean that's. One more, and then I'm going to put this together, yes?
I was going to say, like, social pressures. But then you started saying something about asking why, but I always kind of thought that we should always ask questions and why.
Yeah. Well, at the core of this particular practice is inquiry. Mm-hmm. Right? If you're not doing experiential inquiry, you're not doing this practice. I mean, it's that simple. And then how does conceptual intellectual inquiry, how do these two things fit together? So this isn't saying that, you know, you shouldn't do that or degrading it. It's like so many other things. It has its place. And if you don't use it in its place and in its role, particularly with doubt, you actually increase the problem rather than help solve it. So I'm going to read a quote from Upandita. And excuse me? I'm not going to argue about it. Because it's not subject to an argument. Really, you know. So, so I want you to listen to this quotation because this is really fascinating, because everything we've just talked about from a practice perspective are secondary conditions, not primary conditions or cause. Okay? So Upandita says, the proximate, the primary cause of doubting, and he calls it doubting conjecture, because doubting always has accompanied with it judgments and speculations about how to get out of it, you know, what the problem is, what have you. So the cause of doubting conjecture is the lack of proper attention towards doubt itself and the improper adjustment or refocusing of attention once doubt continues. So now this is a starting place. Now, this is really fascinating, and this is why traditionally, you know, and I'm going to get to this, and you've heard me say this a million times, probably at this point, you know, in the Satipatthana Sutra and in many other places, the Buddha said there are three experiential questions that we should always be experientially investigating when we're meditating and in daily life. Okay? And they are, we'll use doubt here, how is doubt arising? What are the conditions? What are the conditions that it continues? And how does it end? I mean, they're simple, profound questions. And they involve watching directly. So from a traditional practice perspective, the entire practice is about experiential observation, not about conceptually figuring things out. And so he goes on to say, proper attention then is the most direct cure for doubt. If you look correctly and look in the right place, okay, if you look correctly, you will see what you're looking for. The yogi who returns to the clear path of direct observation has the chance to gain insight into the true nature of doubt and reality. If you don't do this, you cannot gain personal, intuitive, real understanding of the nature of the phenomena or doubt. Not only will doubt increase, but the mind will become very tense and rigid, accompanied by aversion, frustration, agitation, resistance, anger, and associated negative mental states. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? Failure to return to the path, however, may allow doubt to reach an incurable stage. Okay. So, looking correctly and looking in the right place mean? Okay, and what Upandita is talking about is that the first and most fundamental practice is making the doubt itself the object of investigation and meditation. You know, rather than what led up to it in the past, or what's going to happen in the future, like right now, in this moment, present moment experience, doubt's there. What is that? What is it doing to the body? What is it doing to the mind? What is it doing to the structure and the way you're thinking? Not the content, but the process. And why is it continuing to be there or starting to dissipate and end? So it's a process, observation, investigation, not a conceptual analysis. Are you with me here? So this is like totally different way than we normally do problem solving, okay? So that's the starting place. So he says, in the first instance, the problem is the failure to do that. You know, I'm starting to, oh, geez, it's the social pressures. And it's the, well, you know, was it this condition or was it that condition that I'm doing this now? And why am I so fearful? And none of those are the issue. The issue is right now, You know, we keep talking about present moment experience. Right now, what is doubt in this body, in this mind? Specifically. And what conditions, you know, whether I'm kind, whether my mind is rigid or flexible, whether there's confusion, how do those things accelerate the doubt or slow it down or increase it or dissipate it? Okay. So you can hear from that, if you were actually able to do that, that the whole issue of this is happening to me, you know, or why is it happening to me, or why am I, they're not even part of the discussion. That's what he's talking about conceptualization. And it's the reason that if you can do it, they talk about, you know, the fire, this agitation of the mind starting to cool. Because the thing that's, you know, drives the fire is attachment and identification and personalization, right? So if you shift over into this mode of practice, you are out of those things. Now they're going to keep coming up. And so the discipline is seeing it arise, you know, noting it like we do other things, and not going there. Coming back to what is happening right now in this body and this mind. I'm not going to go to those questions. This will eventually bring the mind back into balance, and then you can do kind of the sociological, psychological evaluation that you know, we thrive on in the West. But unless the mind is settled and has this coolness to it, that type of evaluation in doubt is not going to get you out of the doubt. That's the problem. So you've got to get the mind back in balance so then I can engage what's happening in multiple ways. Okay. Are we together so far? Okay. So the Buddha used the analogy here of when we're doing actually everything that everybody named. He said, you know, what we're looking for is the heartwood in a tree. And the heartwood is, well, what is the true cause and condition of the doubt in this moment? So when we start thinking about, you know, social pressures or, you know, was the thing that I did yesterday or a half hour ago, is that the reason I'm feeling this way? Or if I'm talking about, Jesus, there's only one choice I can make, and that choice in the future is, and now I'm getting anxious about something in the future that hasn't even happened. All of those are looking at the trees or the leaves and the limbs and the bark on the tree to find out where the heartwood is. You're just looking in the wrong place. So that's where you say you have to look in the right place. Well, the right place to find the heartwood, the true cause of doubt or whatever it is in the trunk of the tree, which is in the present moment of what's happening in your body and your mind. Okay? So let me use kind of a very mundane illustration here. And this is stimulated by an actual experience I had last night. And I've beefed it up just a little bit to be helpful. But so I have a good friend, and every time at this time of year, we have a dinner together where we drink too much and we eat too much, and it's great. You know, it's just fantastic. You know, just like once or twice a year, just wow. And, you know, it'll be like 3 or 4 hours, you know, we just go for it, you know, and it's the kind of thing where we can really talk, and we can talk about the Dharma. And he's a brilliant businessman, and he has actually learned how to apply the Dharma in business. And so that's a lot of our discussions. I can't have that discussion with many people. So it's exciting, you know, it's really exciting. And he has kids, and I have a grandchild, and so we have, so it's great. So last night, we said we're going to have an early dinner at Mulvaney's. That's where we normally go in Midtown. And I'm normally not driving, you know, like between 5 and 6 in that traffic. So I kind of say to myself, well, to get there at 5:30, you know, I'm going to have to leave the house at this time, and I'm not going to take the freeway, I'm going to take this route, and, you know, all this seemed quite reasonable to me. Okay. So I live in Campus Commons. I drive out, and I get to the stoplight at University and Howe. And the light changes 5 times, and I still haven't gone through it. I mean, that's how heavy, you know, the traffic is, right? Well, that's just to get on to Howe, right? So then you get to Howe and Fair Oaks to turn onto Fair Oaks, and that's like 3 lights. So I have to be honest, by the time I got onto Fair Oaks, I mean, I was well on my way, you know, I mean. So, so I'm driving towards Midtown, and it's just, I'm not used to it, you know. And so it's just unbelievable to me, to my mind. It's like this. And so you're on all these streets, and it's just like basically stop and go. And all the cars are lined up, so it's like you'll go 20 feet, and then there will be a sea of red lights, right, lighting up, right? It's, I guess if I was in a Christmas spirit, that would be exciting. Yeah, it wasn't very exciting. So by the time I got just over the bridge by Sac State, you know, I noticed that, you know, I had gone from like being really excited about going to this dinner, and just in that amount of time, which was actually, you know, like maybe 25 minutes, you know, I hadn't even gone maybe 2 miles, that I was just really, you know, getting agitated and annoyed and frustrated, and then I was, you know, I was getting pissed off, and I was getting really, you know, anxious, and then I'm starting to, God, I'm not going to be there at 5:30, right? You know, and then he's going to be disappointed and waiting for me, and, you know, and then like, well, maybe I should have taken the freeway, you know, and or like, well, what do I do now? You know, so, you know, it's right. It's all that stuff that you do, right? It's like, well, do I do this or I do that? And, you know, there's no, and, you know, I start making all kinds of judgments about the plan that I made. And then I start making judgments about everybody in the other cars. then, you know, I notice that I'm really miserable. You know, so then I'm upset about being miserable. You know, it's not enough to be miserable. You have to be upset that you're miserable, right? And, you know, then this thing kind of kicks in about, well, you know, I mean, like, how many years of practice do I have? You know, and then, you know, this proliferation of things. And so, you know, now I'm kind of getting pissed off at myself. Okay, so I better practice, you know. This is not the part, this didn't really happen. I'm going to tell you what happened. But, you know, the story would be, well, you know, I tried that. And, you know, sometimes, I don't care how strong your practice is, you're so wound up, you know, you try to go to your breath and your body, and what it does, it just pisses you off. You know, you're so wound up, right, you can't let down. So you do that. And you know, I'm lost in a stew of judgment, speculation, personalization. I'm not practicing. I'm not in my body. You know, this idea of finding the heartwood is a joke. And I arrive early. That's true. I mean, like, I could not believe it, you know? So I meditated in my car for 15 minutes. So, and because it was 5:30, the parking was actually pretty easy. So then the question is, there's the situation, okay? So what would it look like to, quote, look correctly and look in the right place. So to just kind of break this out, what I'm going to do is just use one of the descriptions that we're all familiar with of what mindfulness is, which you can integrate in all these basic things. So mindfulness being a present moment, non-judgmental, direct experience for the purpose of seeing clearly the nature of what you're experiencing. Okay? So four things. So what Upandit is talking about on non-judgment is that the reason that we have non-judgment, and it's non-judgmental awareness or present moment experience, is that when the mind comes in contact with an experience to get the judgment, you know, it has to have gone through contact, sensation of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral has to have arisen. It then has to have accelerated, in this case, to aversion. And then it has to accelerate it to some level of attachment to some pre-existing tendency for there to be a judgment about it, in this case, a negative judgment. That's basically the format that the Buddha lays out in the Honeyball Sutta. And what is accompanied by that, if that happens, is that it pushes the mind into identification. So you just don't have, from a practice perspective, you know, a neutral negative judgment. You know, it's not like you just, you know, criticize the driver in front of you and, well, it's just completely neutral. I mean, he's obviously a prick. Well, that's not it. I mean, you know, it's escalated up. So the presence of judgment is this, has all of these many things. You know, we kind of treat it like, oh, well, I'm making a judgment, note it, come back. I mean, if the mind is really in judgment as described in this illustration, it's not that. It's just not a judgment popping into the mind. It is part of dependent origination that has moved to a certain place and has gotten traction in your mind, okay? So another, you know, we say non-judgment, but kind of historically they're talking about impartial observation. You know, now in truth, you know, the way we practice is that you have a judgment, and then where you start is you have a judgment, and you don't make a judgment about having a judgment. You know, that's the way it starts. And then at some point, you actually stop for some items in some particular period of time not having a judgment about making a judgment. And then when that starts to happen, the mind starts to cool, and you can just see the judgment, and the mind doesn't hold on to it, so it doesn't escalate and proliferate from that place. That's the idea, okay? So when you hear your mind, as I said earlier, asking a why question, it's almost always going into judgment. That's the danger of it. And anytime you hear the question or the implication being, you know, I, me, or mine, where you're owning it, then you're already down, and the mind is entrenched in identification and in judgments. So watching for and seeing that the mind is judging is the starting place to wake up to, man, there's all these other things that may be going on right now. You know, like this is a, from a practice perspective, a dangerous situation. You know, unless you just enjoy personalize everything. Yeah. Okay. So there's this book from Bhante Gutnarana. He talks about the Honeyball Sutta in this description. You know, there's a way that it's laid out. I think I'm going to give a whole talk. Just it's a fascinating sutta. But he right after, in his book, he lays out this model that I just talked about this personalization and judgment. And he said, judgments or interpretations of perception of what you're seeing or experiencing lead to all sorts of conflicts. The Buddhist solution to this problem is straightforward. We train ourselves to use mindfulness to focus on the simple cognitive aspects of perception without going beyond them into judgments and interpretations. So we just stay with, right in this moment, what does doubt feel like? What is it doing in the body and the mind? And when you see your mind wanting to criticize it, judge it, be sad about it, be angry, that you develop the ability through training to see those and not go there and go back to the direct experience and just stay there over and over and over again. And as I said earlier, if you can do that, eventually the mind just starts to cool down. And so this wavering that's going on and all this agitation, it just all starts to settle because the mind is starting to concentrate itself, and then you can start to open up to do other things. Excuse me?
Simple, brilliant, and difficult.
Absolutely. And that's the reason. I mean, it's just so clear. I mean, thank you. Because, he said, this practice is swimming against the stream. And, you know, to tell somebody, you know, the problem with your doubt, you know, isn't that you have to make a decision and it has a big consequence. It's actually that you're paying attention to the wrong thing. Well, you know, most people you say that to, they have no idea what you're talking about. And frankly, a lot of practitioners don't have any idea what you're talking about. You know, they think, well, I should just be dealing, you know, my real problem is the fear that's leading to doubt. Well, that's not going to get you there. Okay? So this is one of the dangers of doubt, because, you know, like I was saying in this, you know, I'm just driving to dinner and I go from, you know, having kind of a calm, happy mind to being agitated, to being frustrated, to being angry, to projecting that out. Well, you know, it'd be easy to say, I can't believe this problem of anger that I have. You know, why do I always keep getting so angry? That's the wrong question from a practice standpoint. We've got to get back to the origin, and then eventually we can get to that question. But you can actually see and feel directly the answer to that question by this technique. But this is why they call the practice a training. I mean, you have to train yourself to develop a habit to practice this way. This doesn't come naturally. This is not the natural way that the mind operates, or how we've been taught to deal with things in the West, right? Okay. So that's the non-judgment part. So direct experience. You know, so what does that mean? So I was saying, you know, the why issue is going to usually take you into conceptualization. So the Buddha is asking how questions, what questions, you know, like what is present? Well, what's present is my body is tense. My mind is tense and it's rigid. It is not open. There is anger present that is clouding all of my... You with me? That is an answer to a why question. That's a what. And then how did that arise? Or how does it keep arising? So it's like, my mind's really rigid right now. Why does it stay rigid? Well, every time I go 20 feet and I see those lights light up, this whole thing happens in my body. You know, this tension, this resistance against it, and then the agitation and the anger arises from that. So what's the problem? It's at the moment of contact, this initial reaction and resistance. So seeing that and just practicing letting go over and over again, every time that those lights go on, using the lights as a signal to let go, you know, and not go to this other place, is where it starts. You know, we're actually going back to the first original experience right after the moment of contact that then proliferates to all the stuff that we normally think is the problem. So we move from complexity, like, well, why do I keep doing this? I mean, I just keep getting so angry, and, well, why am I anxious and angry? And we go from that to, what happens when those taillights light up? That's not a complex thing. It's just, what happens? And then what do I do with it? That's the starting place. So the whole practice is designed to move from complexity to simplicity. And the simplicity comes from just staying in the moment, because you can only have one of these little experiences in a moment. You know, we may think we are, but we're not having agitation, frustration, resentment, anger, and judgment in the same moment. We're having one of those. Now, they may be happening really quickly, and they may be layered, and that's why it seems so confusing. But if we can just get into the present moment and just to what is happening, then things start to become simple. It's like, well, what I'm dealing with is like this really rigid condition in my mind right now. Every time I see those lights, my mind and my body just goes like this. And then that produces all this other stuff. So this is where I start, not this other stuff, okay? Okay. So that's the direct part. So it's non-judgmental, direct, present moment. Okay, why present moment? Well, the only place that I can experience that is right now. And now, which is different than the now a second ago, I can't experience what was there a second ago, because it's now changed. So this, and this is one of the really tough parts, is seeing that your mind is jumping out of this very simple experience in this moment, seeing that your mind is moving into conceptualization, seeing that your mind is in personalization. All of those things are not in the present moment. And they're not direct experience. They're conceptual experience.
Please tell me what you mean by conceptualization.
Thought, judgment, speculation. Now, in the Honeyball Sutta, the Buddha basically says that we move from this experience I'm having when that taillight lights up, this contraction, this discomfort, this unpleasantness, and staying right there, that the mind doesn't want to feel that fundamental unsatisfactoriness. So what it does is it makes a judgment about it, which is a conceptualization, which immediately moves into identification. You know, I mean, it's like boom, boom, boom. So, okay.
We're really hitting ourselves. Like, isn't it like Heather said, to keep shooting the arrow, second and third, fourth arrow?
Yes, that relates to it, but this is just a little bit different, okay? Because we're trying to get back. It's like there's this chain reaction going on, right? And we're trying to get as far back on the chain reaction in the moment that we can, you know?
I heard you say, correct me if I'm wrong, that attention to the content of thought in these moments is not recommended.
Yes.
And I'm curious as to why, because I, just again, just speaking from my practice, I find it helpful to know or to observe the patterns of my thought so that I don't, eventually it kind of wears out and I'm not I learned not to go there, I guess. But I'm curious why that's inconsistent or incongruent with what the suggestion.
I think there's a difference between seeing that when I'm presented with a certain kind of stimulus, that my mind tends to go into a particular kind of judgment, or a particular kind of rumination, or a particular kind of remembering. So from a practice perspective, we would actually call that direct experience, in the sense of you're actually seeing that. Mm-hmm. You're not adding on a judgment, a conceptual judgment on top of that, saying, well, I can't believe I do that, or, you know, whatever it is. Right. Or, well, what are the specifics of when I remember the past? So it's and I'm not saying that doesn't have a place. I'm saying here the definition of direct experience is that we feel, experience, see something directly without adding a judgment onto the perception.
But it is valid to say, I'm just going to pretend the guy you're meeting is named John, that, like, thinking John's going to be disappointed I'm not there, and then feeling some associated sensation
sure. yeah.
in the body, thinking I was stupid to choose this route, feeling some associated, like, is that valid practice? Is that
sure, sure. But the emphasis is on what's happening in the body and the mind, as opposed to the content. It's like, okay, I've projected into the future, and what's the result of that? Okay. So and it's just a question of refinement. You know, the more you practice, you find out the less you actually have to identify to actually get to this result. You know, we have been raised and trained in a culture where the mind is everything. You know, I think, therefore I am. So the idea that, well, we don't have to go into a cognitive evaluation is counterintuitive. But this practice is based on insight arising from seeing that my mind moves to the idea of in the future something is going to happen and it will be bad for me, whatever it is. And that movement of the mind, what happens? So the content isn't the important thing. You know, John isn't important. It isn't important from a practice perspective that it's a dinner. What's important is the mind has moved into the future, not in the present. A conceptualization about what may happen, mm-hmm. so it's a negative projection, right? Mm-hmm. And that is causing this problem. So that's the reason I don't want to go there, you know? Now, once the mind cools down, you know, there's a whole other level of practice analysis we can do of looking at, in more detail, that particular way of the mind going there. But see, here at this point, you're talking about the mind being really seriously out of balance. So going into the content at all is going to create a problem for the mind settling. Okay.
How do we know our perception is correct? How do we know our perception is correct?
Well, that's the whole issue, right? I mean, we know... I mean, if you practiced at all, you know that our perceptions are always distorted at some degree, you know. And so this idea of being able to say, "Oh, I'm asking a why question," I know that what I'm going to be doing is the perception that I have. It's going to be filtered through personalization, attachment, and judgment. That's not where I want to go. That's what I'm trying to prevent. So having these triggers of, like, you know, if I'm in doubt or if I'm in restlessness or anger and I move to why, or I'm asking questions or thinking thoughts about I, I want to get out of there. And I can go there later, but to get that all settled down, that's not the solution to doubt or anger. It may be that cognitive process may be the answer to some engagement in real life. But in this moment when my mind's out of balance, out of control, I'm confused, that stuff is not going to help. That's the problem, okay? So let me just do this one part and then we'll go. I don't want to go too far here. So the very last part, seeing into the true nature of things, is, and this is a really key part because it goes to what our intention is in practice. We used to talk about seeing clearly the way things are, seeing the true nature of phenomena, okay? So what that underlies is that the purpose of this process that I'm describing is to understand what's going on. And it's the seeing into it that begins to liberate the mind. It begins to settle the mind. Okay? So I'm not doing all of this to feel better. I'm not doing all of this to make it stop. I'm not doing this because it's painful. That's wrong motivation. I'm doing this because I actually wanted to see into what it is and how it's causing me to feel pain and discomfort. And when I intuitively see that, the result is that I start to feel better. The insight allows the mind to start to soften and relax, to open up, not to be afraid of the reactions that are taking place in the body, and allow the mind to settle and concentrate, and that's when we begin to feel calm and perspective comes back. Okay? So this may sound like it's subtle, but I mean, it's a huge thing, because if our motivation, if the real reason we're doing this is just to feel better or to feel comfortable, it impedes our ability to see clearly. It impedes insight. So once again, I mean, like we say, you know, we're swimming against the stream. This is not the message of, you know, everything, right? You know, all of our Western techniques, you know, I want to feel better. That's the reason we're all here, right? It's like struggling, suffering. Are you? Yeah. But in the moment of those taillights coming up, if I'm resisting it and want it to go away, then I am impeding my ability to do this very simple process, difficult but simple process I've described, because the mind actually doesn't want to be there, right? Mm-hmm. It wants to manipulate it, not actually see into its true nature. So those are four things. You know, all of them, when you break them apart, are actually quite simple. But to do them, you know, you really have to train the mind, right?
That's the most brilliant talk I've heard all year.
It's the most what?
You're the most brilliant talk I've heard all year tonight.
Well, you can thank the Buddha for giving the Honeyball Sutta.
She wants you to take her out to dinner.
So the true nature, you know, that we're trying to understand is that, you know, everything from a Buddhist perspective is causation. You know, everything happens on cause and effect. You know, conditions come together and we're doubtful or we're agitated or we're angry. They come to, you know, they're in a different way and we're not that way. And the outcome is wholly dependent on the conditions. And the conditions are changing almost every moment. And so if you just keep doing this, you know, every time, so I'll just, the brief version of when I woke up to what was going on was I decided to use the taillights as my practice. So every time the taillights would light up, because I could see the start was, what woke me up was I was looking at the taillights and I noticed that every time the taillights You know, I kind of went, fuck, shit. You know, like, so I just started watching that. And so every time those, I just watched, and, you know, I could just feel everything collapse. So then I just worked on seeing that, not resisting it, opening to it, and letting go. Well, you know, you say, well, you do it over and over again. Well, you know, I had a lot of opportunity to do it over and over again, you know. And then pretty soon, just doing that, you know, you see, well, it just, I'm starting to feel different. You know, like, it is changing. It's exactly the same thing, but it's changing now. Because the condition of my being willing to do what? Upandita said, refocus my attention on the thing itself. So my mind started to settle. It started to become softer, you know, rather than initially going, I can't believe, you know, okay, let go. You know, so it starts to soften, starts to open, starts to relax, starts to be able to stay there, starts to calm, you know. So by the time I got to Midtown, I actually felt really good. And it surprised me because I couldn't believe how agitated I was, you know. But it's that process of seeing, and you know, when you do it this way and you stay away from why, mm-hmm. and I, me, and my, you know, I, me, and mine, and why just become non-issues. They become non-relevant. I mean, by the time I got to Midtown, I wasn't thinking any of that, and I was feeling fine. You know, so by practicing this way, you actually begin to see that every state of mind that you want to personalize actually is totally dependent on conditions which you can work with. And when you do that, the sense of personalization is either diminished significantly or just disappears. It may come up and you see it, but you don't go to the personalization. You don't go to, this is happening to me. You just go back here. And the reason you do is that when you practice this way, if you can do it, is that once your mind gets just a little bit of traction, it begins to feel nourished. It's like, this is so nourishing. You know, like all this agitation and confusion and wavering and where in it's starting to disappear. So it's, you know, traditionally they call it nourishment, you know, and that the mind starts to become purified, that these energies that are so negative start to soften, start to open, start to settle. And so it starts feeling satisfying. So then it gains its own traction, and it begins to perpetuate itself. You know, it's not like I have to use a lot of effort. No, it's just like if I can just stay there, the solution is the process. It produces a particular result, not because I'm trying to get the result, but because I'm totally committed just to staying there and to seeing into its nature, you know?
It's really easier to do it your way.
The Buddha's way. I mean, if you can do this, you know, it's very, very, very powerful stuff. And the retreat on the 29th, if you're interested, what I'm planning on doing is I'm going to try to augment this by, how are there specific ways that you can train your mind to do this? So I'm going to introduce you to a whole series of practices of the way that you would begin developing the habit when something arises to move your mind into this place, you know, to develop a groove where it falls into a particular approach. So that's about 60% of my talk. But it's a good start. Okay, yeah.
So I don't know if doubting Thomas is getting a bad rap here. And the reason I say that is it just so happens that on Sunday, one of the Zen practitioners gave a talk on doubt. And she went into the direction of the greater the doubt, the greater the awareness. A little bit of doubt, well, you're still not where you want to be. But I was thinking along the lines of your first question was, where does it come from, this doubting thing? And I was thinking maybe the need for perfection, which goes into the area of the need for self-identification, the fear of failure, the need for perfection. But it's all connected to the sense of self. And then how do I avoid it? Well, non-self. And so if I move away from identifying or personalizing, then I'm able to free myself from the doubt that would freeze me from acting.
Well, that's a very sound theoretical conceptual description. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's a theory description, totally for sure. And then based on that description, well, what do? This talk is about, and what the Buddha talked about was not theory, but practice. So it's like, yeah, the problem is personalization. Absolutely. That's the endpoint of dependent origination. But how do you not personalize? How do you not identify? And so it's like, well, what is present? Knowing what is present in the sense of, in this moment, how does doubt, anger, frustration, fear, resentment, projection manifest itself? What keeps it going? What ends it? So you don't answer that as a theory from a practice perspective. It's like, no, right now, what do I do or not do? That's not thinking about it. So there's all kinds of other approaches where, you know, I look at my past, you know, I see that I have a tendency to personalize events and identify with certain things, and that happened because of this. And, well, that can be helpful. But in the moment, that stuff's not going to help you deal with this locked contraction of your mind that's generating fear. There has to be a practice to deal with that. So, yeah.
Your deconstruction of doubt, taking us into the present moment to deal with it, reminds me of a line from a Beatles song that life is what happens when you're planning to go somewhere else. It seems like that's, in a way, what you're saying is that you're missing out on what's in front of you because you're anxious about meeting your friend down in Midtown.
Yep.
And so you've missed out on that experience. And I used to experience that a lot when I'd go over to Point Reyes and come back, and there's this part of Highway 37 between Vallejo. You know, everybody knows it's taking that route.
Yeah, yeah.
And the traffic just backs up like crazy.
Yeah.
And I'm coming back, and I used to get really anxious about it. That, God, sit in line for 4 hours or something. And I realized, well, wait a minute. If I was zooming along at 70 miles an hour, I'd be putting my life in danger. And now I'm just creeping along. And look at this. It's wetlands, and it's like beautiful.
Yeah.
And it didn't trigger me into anxiety anymore. I just thought, well, I'll just be here and experience this beautiful setting, which is really actually quite gorgeous in that
Well, the quote that really relates to this talk tonight from the Beatles is George Harrison, and he said, any path will do if you don't know where you're going. You know, and it's like, well, we all know that we want, you know, eliminate suffering, right? It's like, but, well, Upandita actually says, if you can return to the path of clear observation, you have the chance of liberating the mind in the here and the now. You know, so I know we're late. I apologize. Thank you very much for this holiday season. I know this can be treacherous for all of us, so I hope all of you have a wonderful holidays and have as little suffering as possible. So, okay. Thanks very much.